Welcome to Book Talk. This is Alan Farley. With me now is Chris Bojalian here with his latest novel, Secrets of Eden. Welcome to KALW.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on.
You know, I didn't know what I was getting into when I started your novel, because I started the first chapter as titled Stephen Drew, the first section. Stephen Drew is a minister, and he's telling this story about the deaths of two people in his area. But then there's another section and another, and there are four sections in the book, and it's almost a bit like Rashomon.
It is, and it is by design. I like all of these narrators a lot. I like Stephen, I like Catherine, I like Heather, I like Katie, but I'm not sure that any of them are completely reliable, as Stephen Drew himself tells us toward the end of his section. Believe no one, trust no one, assume all of our stories are suspect.
Right, because at first it looks like a murder-suicide. Then it begins to look like, well, maybe it was two murders, two homicides. And at one point, he even becomes a suspect.
Yep.
And so I thought, wait a minute, I've got to go back and read that first part again. what did I miss? Or what did he leave out? Or what could have been the possibility? So it's really engrossing. I love it.
Thank you. And I loved what you just said, what he left out. Because one of the things that I think it's really important to do as a novelist, when you're creating a narrator who might not be completely reliable, is you can't lie to your reader. That's not fair. Then your book is just a parlor trick.
Right.
So the thing about all four of these stories is that it's not that any one of the narrators actually lies. It's what they choose to tell, what they know and they will admit, versus in some cases what they don't know. And I found that really interesting, and I love the Rashomon comparison. That thank you. That is sort of what I was after.
Well, and Stephen is really having a crisis of his own, triggered by this event. But he decides after the funeral to leave. He had to leave, which just makes him look suspicious.
Right. Yep. Stephen Drew baptizes Alice Hayward on a beautiful Sunday in July. The sky's cerulean. It's in old-fashioned Baptist dunking, and Alice comes out of the water and says, "There." And Stephen says, "There." And it's only 9 or 10 hours later, when Alice is dead, apparently strangled by her husband, and her husband, it seems, has then shot himself, that Stephen Drew realizes when she said "there," she was ready to die. She wouldn't be kept from the kingdom by an ecclesiastical technicality, if you will. And so Stephen does have this profound crisis of faith, realizing that you know, he must have missed an awful lot, and should he have done something else to maybe protect Alice?
Right, because as everyone knew at the time, she was being mistreated, beaten by her husband.
Yep. And domestic violence, domestic abuse in this country, well, we seem to have this strange tolerance and indifference for it. And you can see that in a small village, like the sort of village in which I live, 1,000 people, halfway up Vermont's third highest mountain, and the way we are very capable, even in a small village, of looking away, assuming it's not our business. And you can see it in the big world, in the celebrity culture, the whole idea, and this I find really interesting, the whole idea that in June of 2009, Chris Brown will plead guilty to assaulting Rihanna. And then 4 months later, in October of 2009, the NBC sitcom The Office will use Chris Brown's hit song Forever as the love theme when lovebirds Jim and Pam get married. And
really?
It struck me as this bizarre disassociation.
I didn't know that. Well, now, and another one of your characters, Heather Laurent, who's a famous novelist, has a family history somewhat similar to the daughter. That is Alice Hayward, who's the daughter of
Katie Hayward.
Katie.
Katie Hayward. Yep. Yeah.
Right.
You know,
it's Alice and George, who are the husband and wife.
Yeah. Heather Laurent, who writes wildly successful books with titles like Angels and Aurascapes and A Sacred While, is, you know, pretty sure there's an angel behind every bookcase, and, you know, we all have guardian angels looking out for us. And she is the daughter of a domestic abuse murder suicide herself. Her parents' marriage, Heather's descriptions of her parents' marriage, I think, are in some way some of the most interesting scenes in the book. Not necessarily because of the verbal daggers, the physical violence, but because of the Edward Albee-esque "Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf" quality to Heather Lorentz's parents' marriage. I found those scenes very interesting to write. And I don't read them aloud when I'm touring on behalf of this book because they are really dark. But I find them very, very interesting.
The one thing I felt that the more I read it, the book is my family was nothing like this. I don't think there was ever any abuse in my family. My parents did eventually separate, but I never heard them really arguing. I never experienced any kind of abuse. So I'm thinking, am I the only one? I mean, it seems...
No, you're not the only one. No, gosh, no. Though I think domestic violence in this country is much more common than we know. I mean, here's a statistic from Vermont I find fascinating. Vermont is a tiny state. And when we think of Vermont, we think of beautiful fall foliage, maple syrup, and Ben and Jerry's ice cream.
Right.
But Vermont, a state of 650,000 people, had 16,000 calls in 2008 to the state's 16 crisis centers and domestic abuse hotlines. 16,000 calls. There were 15 homicides in Vermont in 2008, and 11 of them were directly related to domestic violence. And when I wonder about bigger states, if you extrapolate the numbers, there's a lot of scary stuff going on when the doors are closed and the shades are drawn.
Well, what was it that sparked this novel?
Back in 1997, I was researching a book that would become The Law of Similars. And I was in a county courthouse in northern Vermont interviewing a victim's rights advocate, a woman who counsels victims of violent crime. And midway through our conversation, she tossed onto the table between us two Polaroid photographs of head indentations in sheetrock. And I can remember thinking at the time, how hard must you have to shove someone's head into sheetrock to leave an indentation? She told me those images involved a client of hers and an ongoing investigation. It would only be later that I would learn it was a murder investigation. The photos stayed with me. And in 2007, I had a book published called The Double Bind. The Double Bind is about a savage sexual assault on a 26-year-old female social worker named Laurel Estabrook. And in the months after the book was published, I heard from women across the country, from California to Maine, from Washington to Florida, who all wanted to know, had we met? How else could I have heard their story? These were all rape survivors. And they found Laurel Estabrook's attack chillingly, horrifically familiar. And of course, I hadn't met them, but domestic abuse and sexual violence in this country are absolutely epidemic. And I thought once more of those two Polaroid photographs of head indentations, and I embarked upon the book that would become Secrets of Eden.
And that is that there is a case where, I mean, at that murder scene, at the there
yes.
is a, yep. an indentation in the in yep. the wall.
There are head indentations in the sheetrock in that living room. You're absolutely right.
What research did you do about the incidents and the practice? Practice is not the right word, but how it happens.
How it happens? Sure, sure. Though practice is an interesting word to use, one of the victims' rights advocates I interviewed said to me when she was going through the manuscript with me, telling me what was authentic, what was inauthentic, she said, "You did get it right from the batterer's perspective, and they all do it the same way. Somewhere out there is a how-to book, and they've all read it."
Hmm.
I found that really interesting. Hmm. I interviewed victims' rights advocates. I interviewed women who work with survivors of domestic abuse. I interviewed battered women. I interviewed the chief medical examiner for the state of Vermont. And I spent a lot of time with an assistant attorney general in Vermont who spends a lot of time prosecuting cases that involved domestic violence and murder. And they were all really, really interesting. And the thing that came out of it aren't simply some of the background stories and secrets of Eden and that penumbra of darkness. But in all fairness, what also came out of it were some people who are really strong and really smart and really funny. One of the things, I hope first and foremost that Secrets of Eden is a literary thriller in the tradition of Midwives and the Double Bind. No one wants to read a 105,000-word op-ed. But I liked these people I interviewed a lot, and I hope that the sense of humor that some of them has appears in the book. I mean, I think Catherine Benincasa can be very funny.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about her, because the second chapter, or the second section, I should say, of the book is from her point of view. And what I found so refreshing, too, is, of course, she has a completely different point of view, and she's a different character, but you created yet another character. All of these characters are indelible, but individual.
Thank you. Sometimes I think I'm more of a mimic than I am a novelist, especially when I'm writing in the first person like this. I like Catherine Benincasa a lot. When I was conceiving the book in my mind, however, she was going to be a character, but not one of the four narrators. The two narrators were going to be Stephen Drew, the Baptist minister, who's very icy and intellectual, very cerebral, and Heather Laurent, the author the best-selling author, whose approach to faith is 180 degrees different from Stephen's. She's all about faith, and she's a kindergartner. She's a kindergartner's faith in spirituality and angels. She's everything Stephen isn't, and Stephen is everything Heather isn't. And they were going to be sort of a he said, she said.
Well, and they got together for a while, too.
They do get together, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's because Heather is so empathetic. She's so caring. She's so sweet. When I started creating the character of Heather Laurent, I had my tongue firmly in my cheek, and I was not taking her seriously. But I really grew to like her. I grew to like her a lot. I might not completely agree with her, but I don't completely agree with Stephen either.
Right.
And I had a great time with both these characters, and I enjoyed her immensely.
But now tell us about Catherine.
Catherine, yeah. Catherine and her sense of humor.
How she became a narrator. Yeah.
So originally it's just the two narrators, Stephen and Heather. I'm having lunch with an assistant attorney general in Vermont, a woman named Lauren Bowerman. Lauren's very funny. She's great. And she helped me in the construction of characters in Midwives, the state's attorney, The Law of Similars, Leland Fowler, because before becoming an assistant attorney general, she had been the state's attorney for Chittenden County, Vermont. And I was chatting with her, just trying to understand how she would investigate this case, what looks to all the world like a murder-suicide that she believes is a double murder or a double homicide. And I think she's like, you know, I'm eating a cheeseburger or something, and we're at this restaurant in Montpelier, the state capital in Vermont. And I'm trying to understand what happens to a body and a gun depending upon the distance the gun is from the body when it's discharged. And she said, smiling, she said, I get it. You want to know how much of the bastard's brains were up the gun barrel. And I loved the alliteration. I loved the rhythm. And I loved the bluntness. This is a woman who'd said to me in another lunch when she was explaining why, in her opinion, battered women endure relationships. She'd said, yeah, the river denial is pretty freaking wide. And then I said, you know what? This voice is too good not to use it. Mm. You've got to have Catherine Benincasa telling her version of the events herself rather than channeling it through Stephen or Heather Laurent. And so that is how Catherine Benincasa became, you know, 25% of the novel. And I'm really glad she did.
Well, I mean, one of the things that Stephen does right after the murder is to help clean up the place.
Yep, he does, yeah. After, basically what happens in the first few pages of the novel, Stephen Drew baptizes Alice Hayward on a Sunday. Sunday night, Alice and George die. Monday morning, a good friend of Alice Hayward, who's part of the church women's circle, wonders why Alice didn't come to the breakfast they always have on Mondays. So she goes to the house and finds this scene, straight out of an Alfred Hitchcock movie. There's Alice Hayward in her nightgown, strangled on the living room floor. And there is George Hayward with basically half a face. The other half is on the screened window and a bullet, you know, that's gone through his head. And so the Bureau of Criminal Investigation arrives, and the state's attorney arrives, and the medical examiner arrives, and they all take the evidence they need. They get the stuff for the investigation. But in a small state like Vermont, once they have what they need for the investigation and the forensic exams, the Bureau of Criminal Investigation leaves, and someone else has got to scrub the carpet. Someone else has got to scrub the walls. Someone else has got to clean up the mess. And in a small village like Haverhill, Vermont, that falls to the minister and some deacons and some other members of the community to clean up the mess. And so, yes, Sunday morning, Stephen baptizes Alice. Monday morning, he's cleaning skull fragments off the screened window.
Another thing you mentioned, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and as far as Heather's parents are concerned, and it takes me back now. I remember because the mother was a very biting. Her attitude was certainly not like Katie's mother.
No,
a completely different situation. And George's excuse, or not excuse, but one of the things is he'd get drunk. That, and then I guess that's a common thing when. That alcohol plays a large part in abuse.
It does. It plays a large part, and also in the rationalization and the denial. I can't tell you how many women I interviewed who said things to me with an absolute straight face that he's really a good guy some of the time. He really is. He only gets like this when he drinks. Or he's really a good guy. He is under a lot of pressure at work. And that's why he gets like this. And drinking and pressure at work is no excuse. There is no excuse for this kind of behavior. But, as Lauren Bowerman, a.k.a. Catherine Benincasa, said, the river denial is indeed pretty freaking wide.
I'm just thinking, are there any statistics on the reverse, on wives abusing husbands?
I'm sure there are. I don't know them. It happens. I mean, the reality is that... abuse happens across all kinds of domestic domestic abuse occurs across all kinds of domestic arrangements. The lion's share is men abusing women, but certainly there are plenty of cases of women abusing men, of women abusing women, and men abusing men.
But tell us a little bit more about Heather. How did she come into the picture?
How did Heather come into the picture? Well, Heather began as simply that counterfoil to Stephen Drew. But as I got to know her, she grew more interesting to me, and I began to wonder about her backstory. Why does she believe in angels? Why is she so fixated upon angels? And before I knew it, she's got a sister, and she and her sister lost both their parents when they were teenagers, when her father shot her mother and then went to the 12-by-12 pitch in the attic of their home and hanged himself, and she tries to kill herself when she's a freshman in college. She's going to do it via pills. She has everything all set up to take her own life, and just before she's going to take the pills, she sees an angel, and in her opinion, she's making an egregious mistake contemplating suicide.
We're talking with Chris Bojalian about his latest novel, Secrets of Eden. Well, now, when you say the idea of getting a backstory for Heather and so on, did this happen while you were writing, or do you plan things out, have a scenario made in advance before you really start writing?
My books are pretty organic. Usually I depend upon my characters to take me by the hand and lead me through the dark of the tale. Secrets of Eden was a little different, in that I knew the beginning and I knew the end. The only other time I've embarked upon a book where I knew the beginning and the end was The Double Bind. But even though I knew the end, there are a lot of ways to get from A to Z, and the book certainly took myriad detours, and my characters certainly surprised me in myriad ways, particularly Heather, who began as, in my mind, as almost a parody of New Age spirituality. And before I knew it, while I might not completely agree with her, I really liked her. I cared about her. She's enormously empathetic. She's a pretty good egg. And I love her apartment in New York City. Heather Lorentz Loft in Chelsea in Manhattan is my fantasy loft. If someday I have a loft in San Francisco or a loft in Seattle or a loft in Manhattan, trust me, it's going to look exactly like Heather Lorentz.
Well, now tell us about Katie, who narrates the final chapter, or the final section of the book, I should say.
Yeah. Now, Katie is the 15-year-old daughter of George and Alice Hayward. And one of the things that was important to me about Katie was having a likable, interesting, authentic teenager. I love writing about kids. I really do. And in some ways, Katie Hayward is the literary descendant of Connie Danforth in Midwives or Carly Banks in Transistor Radio. The other thing I wanted to do with Katie is in some way convey a taste of the fact that domestic violence affects the children too. When George is abusing Alice, Alice isn't the only victim. Katie is, too, and the way her childhood is going to be scarred by this sort of inexcusable behavior. I like Katie a lot, too.
Well, you know, I mean, as you say, with each section of the book, almost each chapter, things you learn more and things change, and your idea of what's going to be happening or what has happened changes. And I don't want to give anything crucial away because it's such an interesting tale. And you, to start with, I haven't read your work before.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for diving into Secrets of Eden.
Well, I thought, and when I saw that there was a bit of a mystery, I thought, because I love a mystery. Mm-hmm. And you've got that, but there's so much more to it than that. I mean, it's not your standard, you know, procedural detective or police story. But it's a great human story.
I hope it is. I hope it is. I hope it's first and foremost a story about six very interesting characters. And yes, it is kind of a closed room mystery. What happened in that living room when George and Alice had their final fight? What caused it? Why did it end up so tragically? And, you know, some of the characters ruminate upon this. What would have happened if Katie had been home that night? Katie, when her parents have their last fight, is at a rock concert listening to The Fray, you know, 2.5 hours away. What if she'd been home when her parents had been squabbling?
Right. Either it might not have happened or she might have been killed, too.
Absolutely.
I'd like to go back and just ask you about writing in general and how you got started writing. Didn't you have another profession before you started writing?
Oh, most writers do. I mean, the reality is that when you graduate from college, Random House doesn't say to you, you look like a young writer of promise. Here's a boatload of money. Write us a book so you can get a day job. And I wrote my first three novels while employed at advertising agencies in New York City and in Burlington, Vermont. And when I was 31, I left advertising completely, and I've been a full-time writer for the last, 17 years now. Wow. And here's two interesting facts about my first novel. A Killing in the Real World is the single worst first novel ever published, bar none. It's a terrible, terrible novel, but here's a fun fact behind it. I was working in an ad agency in New York City, and there was another novelist more established than I, who worked in that ad agency. He'd already had a reasonable amount of success, and he was kind enough to blurb that first book, and that first blurb was from James Patterson.
Wow. Well, there was this recent New York Times Magazine story about him.
That's right.
He's really an industry.
He's an industry. He produces a lot of work. He employs a lot of people. Yep, and in some ways, I think the magazine article is right. He's transformed the notion of the blockbuster.
So your first terrible novel was published.
Yeah, my first terrible novel was published. But the reviews didn't, and the justifiably bad reviews it received didn't stop me from wanting to be a writer. It's what I love to do. I mean, even as a very young man, other than hanging around with my wife, there was nothing I liked to do more than write. It gave me enormous pleasure. So I wrote a second book, a perfectly adequate New England ghost story, and a third book about a couple grieving for the loss of their 10-year-old son to leukemia and the father's decision to coach what would have been his son's Little League team, even though his son is no longer on it. It's called Past the Bleachers. And it became a really delightful Hallmark movie with Richard Dean Anderson and Bernard Hughes and And that was a really well-timed event, because that happened about 3 months after I had left working at the ad agency, and you're cobbling together a life as a novelist and a journalist and figuring out how you're going to make the mortgage and the health plan each month. And so it was a great gift. But I think my breakthrough book certainly was my fifth novel, Midwives. That was the first book that was bought in large numbers by people not related to me by blood. And certainly one of the reasons why it had such enormous success is thanks to an absolutely delightful talk show host in Chicago named Oprah Winfrey, who picked it for her book club, which will always be one of the greatest professional blessings I will ever have. I don't think anyone has done as much in my lifetime to remind us of what words and reading and books can mean to the soul as Oprah Winfrey.
Well, now, what occasioned your move to Vermont?
My wife and I were working in really yuppie Reagan-esque jobs in the late 1980s. I was working for J. Walter Thompson, and she was working for Shearson Lehman as a bond trader on the 104th floor of the World Trade Towers. And we were trying to figure out how I could be the novelist I wanted to be, and she could be the fine artist she wanted to be. She's a fine art photographer. When one night, on March 8th, we left a party in the East Village, hailed a cab for Brooklyn, where we live. And as anyone who's watched Sex and the City faithfully knows, cab drivers hate to go to the outer boroughs on a Friday or Saturday night because there's no return fare. The cab driver's furious, but he has to accept us. He's racing on the FDR Drive south to Brooklyn, gets a speeding ticket. And while he's getting his ticket, I said to him, "Excuse me, sir, why don't you turn off your meter while you're getting your ticket?" Well, he did, but he was furious. And after the police officer had left and he had his ticket, he proceeded to take my wife and me on a 40-minute joyride, not in Brooklyn, ignoring all stoplights, all traffic signs, and screaming obscenities at us. My wife and I vowed if he ever came to a stop, we'd bolt out opposite sides of the cab. And after 40 or so minutes, he did come to a stop. So we bolt out opposite sides of the cabs, and we understand why he's come to a stop there. There's a police officer standing at the corner. So I go up to the police officer and I say, "Excuse me, sir, there's an extremely discourteous cab driver pulling away." And the police officer said, "Get down now." So my wife and I hit the pavement, and then we understood why he wanted us to get down. There were three guys spread eagle against a brick wall with Tower Record bags overflowing with guns and drug paraphernalia, and six other police officers with their guns out. They just stormed a crack house. And my wife, who grew up in Manhattan, whispered to me, "Why do we live here?" And I said, "I don't know." And the next day, the New York Times travel section had an article on Burlington, Vermont, and we decided to scope it out.
Well, we're out of time, but that's a great story. Right. This is a great story. What you've got another one already underway?
I do. I've got a very rough draft of a book that will be out at some time in 2011, later 2012, and I like that book a lot.
Well, Chris Bojalian, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be on the show. Thank you.
Secrets of Eden by our guest, and it's published.
It is published by Shea Earhart Books, a part of the Crown Publishing Group, a part of Random House.
Thank you.
You bet.
Book Talk is now available as a podcast. You can receive an MP3 of Book Talk every week free of charge for your MP3 player or home computer. Links to subscribe to all of KALW's local podcasts are available at kalw.org. And that's Book Talk for this week. This is Alan Farley. Thank you for listening.